Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 19th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Dale Jomptgaard. Today's session number is 2003 and is titled, Dare We Walk in the Newness of Life? What kind of sin dulls our senses, saps our life, and deadens our spirit? Let's listen in.
Hey, I appreciate you coming in to do some thinking with me. I'm Dale Jomptgaard from Portland, Oregon, retired as a pastor, also been a psychotherapist, and the director of life education for Lutheran Family Service. And I have been coming to Holden since about 1970, doing classes about every 3 to 4 years. So it's always a great experience to be here, and I find the people in the classes here are very open and interested and ask awfully good questions. So thank you for being here. Those who haven't been in on any sessions, what I'm doing here is creating a bit of a different model based on what I see coming up in the new approaches of science, quantum physics, and other things related to research of prayer, etc. And essentially what it is, Jesus said, if your eye is sound, your whole body will become full of light and you will become bright as a lamp. That sounds like a very here and now kind of thing, an ongoing process. Quantum physics tells us that essentially we are made up of particles that are happenings, like bursts of energy that happen over and over. And so some physicists begin to say, well, what exists between bursts of energy? And what seems to exist is purpose. That the bosons or particles keep happening with a common purpose, so that the bosons of my arm keep happening as my arm. Thank goodness. And so if what exists between bursts of energy is purpose, maybe what things are made of is purpose. And that should not surprise us too much, because we hear in the scriptures, and the Word became flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made through Him, through the Word. And in the creation story, and God said, and it was. However, what this is has opened up for me is the possibility that creation wasn't something that happened once, as we have tended to think, although there are theologians and others that haven't thought that, and even Luther thought of a very active God in ongoing creation, but that God is always saying the Word that becomes you. And that it's an ongoing dynamic process, that you are a happening, that you're not an it, and that God is always saying the Word that becomes you and everything else in creation. So this is an attempt, at least, to depict for an individual, and has other implications for the way we belong to each other and are not isolated in the world, but this was just for an individual. And that is, Scripture talks about God being present in light, which we might think of as energy, in love, which we think of as purpose, and in spirit. So what I'm depicting here is that God's light, love, and spirit is always present, becoming present. And that we then become a manifestation of God's love, light, and spirit. That we are the particles and the purpose and the spirit that is manifested each moment. Now, the advantage of that, we bought into a Newtonian physics, Cartesian physics, which tended to say, all we need to do is figure out the it, and we will understand everything. And so we thought of ourselves as an it. Modern medicine has kind of approached treating a person as an it, All we need to do is pour in certain chemicals and remove certain parts or fix them and so forth. And we've tended to think then that I am this it. And one of the problems I think we've had is that it's hard to conceive of how faith could affect a whole it. So when Jesus says, if you have faith, you can do this, do that, and so forth, it's been hard for us to fit that into this kind of paradigm. Also, we've tended to think of I'm here and God is there, and therefore I believe in God, and faith is something that somehow comes from me and bridges the great gap with God. In this model, God is always the source of my aliveness. Jesus said, man shall not live by bread alone, but shall live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And so there is a dynamic relationship that is always happening. I am never separate from God. I am always dependent for my every moment of being on God. And so faith is a way to participate in that, to receive it, to manifest it. And so it's, in addition to being belief, it is participation, it is active. It's not something I believe and now it's all taken care of. And so being created in the image of God and tuning in by faith, and I use a homely example for this, the television set. If you have a television set that's plugged into the wall, and all you have is a television set, you can't have a television set, because if you don't have a sending station, you have no television set. And that helps me a kind of model. You can't be who you are apart from a connection, an ongoing connection with God, so that you aren't some separate entity or being. You are always who you are by the grace of God. That is an ongoing given. And so when Jesus says, if your eye is sound, your whole body becomes full of light, it sounds to me like the tuner on the television set. When you are really tuned into God and God's will and God's presence and God's love, you come to life, you have life and have it abundantly. And so faith then is that way of tuning in and participating. And like the television set, if it isn't tuned in, you get static, you don't get color, black and white, you get blur and everything. That's what we're like when we're not tuned in. So tuning into God is a part of coming to life. And that's why Jesus, I think, said, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. So that raises the question that I want to deal with today. How are we out of tune? How do we mess it up? How do we deaden ourselves and our capacity? How are we out of sync? How are we static? And that's what I think Jesus is getting at. Any questions on that summary? Okay. I like to include experiential stuff as well as talk, and so I'd like to begin with an experience. And what I would invite you to do is put your papers and pencils down and kind of get centered on your chair or the floor or wherever you're at. And then I invite you to close your eyes if you feel comfortable doing so. And bring your awareness to your breathing. And just notice it. You don't need to do anything about it. Just notice your breath as it comes in and goes out. Now move your awareness down to your feet. Be aware of how they touch the floor. To be aware is to be with. Don't need to do anything about it. Just be with whatever is there. So be with the balls of your feet, your toes. And be filled with God's Spirit. And now let your lungs fill with air, receiving the breath with thanksgiving. And as you exhale, let yourself become present to the room. I'd like to invite you to turn to someone near you and share just a couple of things that you've noticed about your experience. What was happening in you? An hour of sleep at least. What are some of the things you noticed happening?
Relaxation.
Okay. Some things were letting go in you. Is that what you mean by that?
Loosening up.
Okay.
I felt warming up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Tingles in my fingers, in my feet.
Mm-hmm. It made me feel all fragile, I must.
Made you feel fragile.
When okay. You first talked about the feet. Recognize the fact that, oh yeah, all these blisters from yesterday. my ankles, and it took me back to almost the journey of my past, and each point that you brought me through to was kind of like, oh yes, I remember hurting this portion of it.
Wow.
Okay.
It just, brought me back to things that I've done and what happened. And then at the last, the deep breath that just brought that relaxation and just calmed everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. People usually experience letting go. It's like releasing. Each part of you begins to let go, and as you let go, the blood begins to flow, and the tingling, and the warming, and the aliveness. One thing I read is that Tibetan monks, after they receive their training in meditation, are put out on a lake with a wet sheet over them, and they are to meditate till their body heat can dry the sheet. Out on a frozen lake, not to mention. And, so we have, and that warmth and that vitality is what it means to be fully alive. Our organs function well when we truly are at peace. That's what the peace of Christ is about. It is the wellspring of aliveness. So then we might ask, well, what's all that tension about? What's all that holding? And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today, is where that comes from. A part of the clue is in something that is very familiar to you, something that has to do with the very flow of blood in you, the very vitality and health of your body. And it is the phrase, you are justified by grace through faith. That's very familiar to you, but often we think about that as something that happens up there. Not that it is the experience, it is the essence for health and vitality. Now, if the answer is being justified by grace through faith, what is the problem?
I would think that a big part of the problem would be shame and self-judgment. Fear.
Okay. Fear, shame. Guilt?
Doubt.
Doubt?
Rejection.
Okay. Now, out of shame, fear, guilt, and doubt, what do we do?
Tend to hide or pull into ourselves, pull away.
Right. Mm-hmm. We create the masks. To hide it. Somehow we need to look good. And so I'd like to explore that. Where do we find that in Scripture? Well, a little context is Freud tried to figure out what basically motivated people. And he said pleasure, the desire for pleasure. And Alfred Adler came along and said, no, it's not pleasure. What people really want is power. And Viktor Frankl came along and said, no, it's not pleasure or power. What people really want is meaning, significance. And he said, when I was in the prisoner of war camps, those people that really survived had a sense of meaning and purpose and self that was far above and beyond the prisoner of war camp. Because they would lose all pleasure and they would lose all power. But those who had a sense of meaning in their life survived. So what is sin? Well, we often think first of the Ten Commandments, and that tends to lead us towards thinking about what we do. And that can be a trap, because sin has to do with what we do, but it is far, far deeper than that. And we get an idea of what sin is about in the temptations of Jesus. Notice, as Jesus goes out into the wilderness, the devil comes to him and addresses him with one word to begin with. You remember what that word is? It's two letters. If. If.
You are the Son of God.
You are the Son of God. Notice what that word if does. Question mark. Doubt who you are. And once we begin to be afraid of who we are, afraid that we're not enough, afraid that we're insignificant, then we have the climate for the three temptations. And so the devil says, well, Jesus, why don't you turn these stones into bread? Now, is it a sin for Jesus to turn stones into bread? After all, he fed the 5,000. Is that a sin? Not in and of itself. So how does it become a sin? When it is done to prove one's worth. When the motivation is to prove one's significance, prove one's worth, prove that you are the Son of God. It was not to be proven. He was the Son of God, and it was to be believed and trusted and accepted that he was the Son of God. He was who he was by the grace of God. Nothing to be proved. But the temptation is then, prove by what you do. So the basic temptation that all of us experience is prove who you are by your abilities, what you're able to do. The second temptation, the devil says, hey, throw yourself off the pinnacle and get God to send his angels to take care of you. Is it a sin to trust God? No. What makes it a sin?
Bring God to the test.
Right. To manipulate God in order to make God so I could feel significant. So the second...
Also be having God prove that he's trustworthy in doing that?
Right. To make God, but then who is God if God's proving to me?
Exactly.
But for the most part, the second temptation is that you will know you're somebody by the reaction and response you can get from other people. And so we go through life manipulating and trying to get people to like us and affirm us and praise us, etc., etc. And if we can get enough of that to happen, then we can feel significant. And again, what's the sin of it? The sin is not accepting who I am by the grace of God, but thinking that I can prove that worth by the reactions I evoke from others. The third temptation is, hey, Jesus, just bow down to me and I'll give you dominion over all the lands of the earth. I would paraphrase that to say you will know that you're somebody by your possessions and your positions. Your positions of power and the things you have. And so we too then are tempted to prove who we are by our various positions and possessions. Now, what happens? Well, if I'm going to prove who I am by what I do, then I have to keep doing and doing better and better. Because what happens is I do something good and I get some praise for it, but that doesn't really meet that deep anxiety about being nobody. So it means next time I've got to do it better, or I've got to do it more. And so what begins to happen? I begin to make myself be what I think I need to be. And what does that do inside of me? That creates that tension that we were dealing with. That creates that anxiety. That creates that strain. And eventually, that creates our dis-ease. Because tension shuts down the blood flow to various parts of the body. Tension shuts down the immune system. When we shut off the blood, parts of our organs don't work well. They become sick and diseased. So our illnesses grow right out of the sin of trying to make ourselves be somebody. And the second one, what happens in relationships? Well, I find some people who respond to me and make me feel good. And then I need to make sure that keeps coming. We find a spouse who makes us feel good at first, and we've got to make sure that keeps coming. And often that's what begins then to put the real strain on the relationship. When you've got to make me feel important. And when you don't, then I begin to either get indifferent, well, if that's the way you're going to be, or I start getting angry with you or frustrated with you because you're not giving me what I think I need to be somebody. So I manipulate you more and more, and the more I manipulate you, maybe the more you react negatively and back away. And when finally you won't support my somebody and you begin to threaten who I think I need to be, I get so mad, I'm hostile, and I want to hurt you, and I want to tear you down, and I want to destroy you. That's what happens in relationships. As they begin with that life, and then when we don't get what we think we need, we start hurting more and doing manipulating more, which finally destroys relationships. What happens with possessions? Jesus talks about the man who has to build bigger and bigger barns. I get certain possessions and I feel good, but then tomorrow they don't make me feel as good, so they don't seem to handle the anxiety about being nobody, so then I have to have more. So I need the second car and the second television and the bigger house and the bigger this. And there's a never ending. Talk about the problem of consumption. It is driven by the need to prove our worth, which is the essence of sin. Positions the same way. People need more and more power, more and more significance. And so we build whole lifestyles. And we destroy ourselves, we destroy our relationships, we misuse and destroy the earth, we misuse our institutions and destroy them. That is what it means to try to justify yourself, to be self-justified. And that's how sin is so insidious. It permeates all of life. And we usually are not even aware of how it's operating. So if we think of sin only as acts, it's hard to think of being enslaved to sin. And so when we are set free in the gospel, it's no big deal. Because we haven't gotten in touch with the problem. We haven't realized that our whole life is a matter of living out these ways of proving our worth. Now, sometimes we talk about pride. It's deeper than that. It's our whole motivation. So often we don't recognize it at all. Now, Jesus talks about this in a number of ways as he talks about sin. In the Sermon on the Mount, he starts with these big things, you shall not murder. And then he goes on to say, however, I say to you, don't be angry. You shall not commit adultery. I say to you, don't be lustful. Notice how he moves to the motivation beyond the act. He says, do not divorce except in unchastity. Do not swear at all, but say yes and no. Not an eye for an eye, but turn the other cheek. These are the ones he starts with. But notice then very soon he moves on to this level. Beware of practicing your piety before others. Give alms in secret. What's he dealing with? That need to prove our own worth, to be seen, to be recognized, to get credit, etc., to justify ourselves. Then he says, prayer. Well, certainly anyone praying, that must not be sinning. Pray not as the hypocrites, for they love to stand and be seen. Pray in secret. So even prayer, now notice he talks about giving alms can be our sin. Praying can be our sin. And he says, don't heap up empty phrases. when you pray. Again, to kind of prove something by how you pray. So then he says, when you fast, do not look dismal. Put oil on your head and wash your face. Evidently, the hypocrites would, or the Pharisees, would look very sad and very dismal and so forth and look like they're really, really doing a big deal when they fast. And then do not store up treasures on earth for yourselves. Notice, these are religious things. How often do we think of our praying, our way of praying, our way of worshiping, our way of giving alms, our way of doing this, could be the essence of our sin? That's how insidious sin is. That's what it means to be enslaved, is that the very best can be affected. And that's why Jesus says it's harder for the rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for the camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Because it's hard for the rich man to be aware that he is enslaved to his riches. He can't let go of them, so he can't really hear the gospel. And the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and said, hey, I've kept the commandments, I've done all this. What do I need to do to inherit the kingdom of heaven? He says, go sell all that you have and give it to the poor. Does he mean that all of us have to go sell all that we have and give it to the poor? Might not be a bad idea because it's a good place to start, but I believe it's an awareness exercise. He really wants the rich young ruler to realize that he isn't really free. And so Jesus wants us to realize that we aren't really free. And he wants us to become aware of how enslaved to these many ways that we have, that we actually are. Now, how does this happen in life? Let's talk a little about it. Bring it down to maybe ways that you remember. When you were a child, do you remember some times when you felt insignificant, not enough, something wrong with you, afraid of being present? I think most of us, if we think, I remember just being totally embarrassed by being skinny and weak. I thought I was skinny and weak and worthless. And who would ever, you know, want me and that kind of thing. I think if we really look, we all get some of that kind of message from our parents. They get frustrated with us, they get angry with us, and they begin to negate our worth as an individual. At least we experience it that way. I think that parents do this out of their own anxiety about who they are, and maybe this is the way the original sin gets passed on. Now notice the original sin. What was it? Adam and Eve ate of the tree of knowledge. And notice what it said right after they did that. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig and made loincloths for themselves. They became self-conscious, and as a result of that, needed to hide. So the very gift, which is, I think, as far as we know, a unique capacity of human beings to be self-conscious, that very gift is what leads us to begin to be anxious about, gee, I'm aware of who I am, but am I enough? Am I really adequate, enough, significant, important, so forth? And as we begin to question that, we begin to need to hide for fear that people will see us for who we are afraid we are. So, some messages that you may have gotten as a child. These are came out of transactional analysis, but they're a wonderful summary I've found. Don't be. Some children get the feeling that they just shouldn't exist, that they're in the way, and there's something wrong with them, and life would be better if you weren't here. And I've counseled with numerous people who have had that kind of feeling growing up as a child. Don't be you. There's something wrong with you. You're too much this or too little that, or etc. Why can't you be like Susie down the street? And we get the feeling that there was like me. I was skinny and weak, and that was wrong with me. So I wasn't really of worth. Don't be close. Some families are so busy that the children are in the way, and they get the feeling, don't be too close to me because I'm anxious or I'm busy or I'm etc. Don't belong. Some children grow up and are sure that they're adopted because they have this feeling, I just don't belong. And maybe two or three children really feel belong, and then one child feels really out of it. So sometimes we get that kind of feeling. And don't, Johnny, go out and find Susie, and whatever she's doing, tell her don't. The feeling that whatever we do, whatever we are, it's wrong. Now this is a way, this kind of stuff, this anxiety, this is the big if of the devil. And somehow we pass that if onto our children. Try as we may to avoid it. We all do it, I believe, and that's how it gets passed on. Because somehow we all become that anxious person underneath, afraid maybe we're nobody. That creates then the climate for the temptations, and I'm sure we as parents didn't realize we may have been tempting our children, but we often have a way that they can become important. So the child is listening, what do I have to do to be significant? Well, just be perfect, try harder, hurry up, be strong or be attractive or be able in some way. Don't show your feelings, that kind of a message, be this, or it's different for women often or girls. All you need to do to be significant is please me, says mother or father. And so the child is always tuned into other people. What do I have to do to please you? Because if I don't please you, then I'm nobody. And be responsible. Now, and there may be others for you, various kinds, but these are some samples of things that we try to be, we get the sense as a child that if we can just do this enough, we will make it. I got a hurry-up message, and I got it from my dad, and when I think about my dad and the model that he showed me about how you have to live life, I think of him running, mowing the lawn. He was always, hurry up, we've got to get it done faster, faster. And I thought, boy, if you just hurry up enough. And so one of the ways I've noticed that is when I drive, I often drive with a hurry up. And I haven't been really aware of it, but as I learned this, one day I was out driving, and it was a Sunday afternoon, I was really going nowhere. And I found myself, vroom, vroom, vroom. I was really gonna get there, hurry. And I said, wait a minute. So I discovered I could give myself permission of, what was the permission? enjoy the getting there. Enjoy the getting there. Yes?
I'm having trouble with only one little part of it, and that's the part about being responsible. I don't, because the alternative is being irresponsible, and that's not something we want to teach anyone.
Good question, and I'm going to answer that next.
The only reason I have signs all over my classroom is just by teaching nothing else. Thank you, be responsible. That's what I want to learn.
Okay, well, you may want to change the signs after listening.
That's why I asked.
Because to give you a very personal experience, my own experience in growing up, we were a very active family in the church. And when we'd come home from church, we'd talk about how things went, and if they didn't go well, how we were going to take responsibility to do something about it. So I got the feeling as a child that if I was just responsible enough for everything and everybody, then I'd really be somebody. So I go on, and I'm always helping people, and I'm always at church. I did everything. In fact, I got so responsible, I'd go to church on Sunday, and I'd help get the chairs, and I'd help with the ushering, and I'd help with this and make sure this was done. And I finally left the church at age 16 and went to another church because I said, I can't worship here. I am so caught up in being responsible. Now, the other thing is that in my life, I had to be responsible. So I went on, became a social worker and a pastor. You know, how responsible can you get? But other things is that when I would meet people, I would have to find out what your problems were and solve the problem so I could be the responsible one. Was I caring?
No.
Was I loving? No. Did it look caring? Did it look loving?
Maybe.
But finally, it probably didn't feel that way to people because I had to manipulate them in order to make me be significant. So notice, I developed my skills. It was my strength to be a problem solver. It was my strength to be responsible. So the very thing that was my strength was the essence of my sin.
That is. How old were you when you figured that out?
Last week.
Right. Well, I probably mid-20s, and I began in training in psychotherapies and so forth, and really began to understand how this works. And now, that to me might help you understand how insidious it was. That often if I was up there preaching a sermon that I wanted to be very helpful, and I'm teaching this class and I want it to be very helpful, it can be the essence of my sin. Now what I found is, I had pains in my shoulders because I was trying to make it all happen, and I would get exhausted and I would push myself and I would drive myself to take on all kinds of responsibilities and do everything. Man, I was really making it all happen. Wasn't I great? Yeah. And then I realized that I do not need to be responsible in order to become somebody. But I could be responsive to people's needs because I am somebody by the grace of God. And that was the basic shift. That we do what we do not in order to become somebody, but because we are by the grace of God. That we can respond, we can do. So again, the things I was doing, there was nothing wrong with them. It was why I was doing them that created all the tension and all the problem. Now, how then do we begin to deal with this? Like you, I said, I don't want to give up being responsible. Like the rich young man who was afraid to give up his possessions. We build this significance way of proving our worth, and we're scared to death to let go of it. Because if we do, it feels like we will be nobody. That's why Jesus needed to die. He who finds his life, he whose efforts to prove his worth is relatively successful, will lose it. He who loses his life for my sake We'll find it. If you want to follow me, you must die in order to live. What must die? The self that we've created must die. Hear it in this language. Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus, we baptized into his death? Therefore, we've been buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in the newness of life. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. We know that our old self was crucified with him, so that the body of sin might be destroyed and we might no longer be enslaved to sin. For whoever has died is freed from sin. But if we have died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him. We know that Christ, being raised from the dead, will never die again. Death no longer has dominion over him. The death he died to sin once for all, but the life he lives to God. So you also must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus. Therefore, do not let sin exercise dominion in your mortal bodies. Get that body connection. This isn't just a thing in our heads. It's not just belief. It's just not justification by God somewhere up there. It is a body thing. It is every cell of our body is involved. Do not let sin exercise dominion in your mortal bodies to make you obey their passions. No longer present your members to sin as instruments of wickedness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and present your members to God as instruments of righteousness. For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are under law. You are not under law, but under grace. So Jesus says, come, die with me. And what I see in that is he's saying, come, and I'm going to lose all of my physical abilities as they drain the blood out of him, and he has no more physical capacities. So you who are afraid of losing your physical capacities and abilities by which you prove your worth, discover you can let go of all of them. Come with me, he said, and I will be rejected by all. I will not be approved or affirmed by anyone. And they rejected him, and they spit on him, and they mocked him. So that you can know that you do not need to have the approval of any other person in order to know your worth by the grace of God. And come with me, and they will cast lots for all my possessions, and they will mock my position as King of the Jews. Ha ha. So die with me that you discover that you can lose all that you think you have to have, and you will be free from that attachment, from that worry, that anxiety, and you will know a deep, deep sense of peace. Because you will know that you are who you are by the grace of God. And you can rise with me and walk in that reality in a whole new way. That is what the transformation is about. Now, to reflect on that, spend some time saying, what are my strengths and how do I use them to justify myself, to prove my worth? And could I let go of them? Reframe them like I did. Not be responsible in order, but be responsive because. Another way Luther talks about the need to die daily. This is not a one-shot deal. So each evening when you're going to bed, say, what am I hanging on to? What am I anxious about? What am I holding on to? I'm not going to let them go, or I'm not going to forgive that person. Or, you know, notice what you hang on to and lift it up to the Lord and let yourself experience letting it go. That's a daily process that we need. It is what confession is about, is a daily process of recognizing our enslavement. And we do this in the light of our baptism. Because we remember our baptism because that is the sign and symbol that says, you are who you are by the grace of God, and God loves you and affirms you and gives you your worth without any need to justify or prove anything. That's what baptism is about. So remember that baptism and say, yeah, I got to remember, I am somebody by the grace of God. I don't have to prove anything to anybody. And then the Eucharist. We tend to expect the Eucharist to do the whole thing for us, like it's magic. The Eucharist is related to this process of confession and awareness. It is the celebration, it's the ritualizing event that lifts it up, but we need to do our homework. When we come to Sunday morning and we haven't given any thought to it, and we run through the Eucharist as though that took care of it. Is it any wonder that we don't walk out singing and joyous and saying, I'm set free? Wow! Because we expected nothing, we prepared for nothing, and often we get very little. So the Eucharist is very significant, but it is the culminating celebration. It is not the transformational process, and we need to be involved in that. And we need help with that. We need help both in our individual lives. We need groups in our churches where we're willing to talk about these kinds of things and how, like an alcoholic talks about, I'm an alcoholic. We need to talk about how I'm enslaved to the things that drive me. And we need to struggle like Paul. The things I would, I do not, and the things I would not, that I do. And we need to love and care for each other as we deal with these issues in order that we might be more fully set free to more fully be filled. This is what I think the gospel is about. Now, I have one more pitch and I'm running out of time. So this one I think is equally significant. This whole process of self-justification that we see in individuals is also true for institutions. That institutions start out with an aliveness and they start out with their strengths, and then they begin to use their strengths to justify and to prove their worth. We are a great church because we've got a great theology, aren't we? We're a great church because we've got a great liturgy. Notice how our strengths can become our idolatries. Emerson had a way of saying it. He said, institutions start out, or the church starts out, with golden people and wooden chalices. And it ends up with wooden people and golden chalices. We as the Lutheran Church have a lot of wonderful gifts that we've received, but they may be coming deadened in the process. And we need to find ways to confess our own enslavement to sin. It's in our theology, it's got to be in our practice, as well as we for individuals. Well, care to ask any questions or make any comments?
Up in the book yet?
I'm trying to get to that. Yes. Part of my wanting to be on faculty was to put a process or some of this in order so that then I can write it out. So you're guinea pigs. Yes.
I by no means want this to turn in how to raise your children type seminar here. But what you were saying is how to instill values, or not really how to instill values, but how do you give your children the values that you taught that we would like them to have? Responsibility for one is what we were talking about here. Maybe being on time, which would all be a responsibility. How can you instill these values on them without overburdening them and without making them feel resentment towards you then? I had kind of a hard time understanding exactly how to do this, given knowing that they came to us without any instructions, you know.
Right.
How do you install this stuff without overburdening?
Sure. One thing that comes to mind, and that's a big question, and I don't pretend to answer it with one pat answer. One is separating being from doing. I love you because you took out the garbage. Oh, you're such a dear boy, you took out the garbage. What's the message?
I'll take the garbage away.
By what you do, you will determine your worth to me. And we tend to connect being and doing. Oh, you're so wonderful because you did this. Oh, you're so wonderful because of this, and so forth. So, to say, oh, you're so wonderful because you're a child of God and it's really neat that you did this, is separating the being and the doing.
I guess I have a comment to say to you, and that is if we start with this attitude of how can we help our kids get this, we're putting the cart before the horse. The best way kids learn is by watching what we do. You know, I try and tell my kids to do one thing, I'm doing another, they're going to learn by my example. And so maybe one of the first things for us to do is to figure out how this can be in flesh within ourselves. And then our kids will get it because they're around us who are in this struggle.
So if I'm saying, oh boy, what are the people going to think of me? I did this or I did this. Mm-hmm. Or I'm so shy or I don't do this. Yeah. Or look at me, I did this.
Honey, don't those yell. The walls are thin at Holden and everybody will hear that you're having a tantrum. Just a little personal sharing.
I got it. We might not have time to deal with this, but as you're talking about sin in terms of self-justification, and there's obviously a corporate nature to that because, you know, if you buy into profit, you surround yourself with people who are all also buying into all that. What about secret sins like pornography? I mean, it's so easy to have that secret sin now, sitting in front of your computer and dabbling in pornography, and it doesn't seem to fit that same self-justification thing, you know, because what are you trying to prove to yourself, to anybody else, because it's only you, your computer.
Well,
there's other sins like that, but that's the one that came to mind.
What prayer is expressing our intention and wanting it to happen. So often pornography, even though it's secret, if we are intending something to happen, we are affecting what will happen. It's not an isolated event. It is communicated.
Plus the fact we're trying to be accepted by something where we don't feel we can be accepted somewhere else.
Right. Oh.
Right. And you know, part of what drives pornography is some very negative attitudes towards sexuality, so that people grow up with a feeling that they really need to hide their sexuality and be embarrassed by it or ashamed by it, and that without feeling good about being sexual, we try to meet some of that need with pornography.
It also loses mutuality, which is one of the gifts of sexuality, is that there's a giving and a receiving, where pornography tends to be about meeting my needs without anything being expected of me.
Mm-hmm. I think for myself, there's a, if I enter into that place of forgiveness where I believe on the core level that I am forgiven and that grace is there, I tend to look at my human failings from a much more distant place because I'm not condemning myself for them. So if I'm looking at pornography and I'm not liking that about myself, there's a lot more light in the room for me to sort of separate all that out and come to terms with what's going on inside of me, because the shame's out of the picture.
Okay, yeah. And to deal with it with the kind of straightness that Paul does. And that there are things that I do that I don't want to do. I really struggle with these things. And then just turning to the grace of God and saying, I lift it up and forgive me, and yet be with me in the struggle. The problem often in terms of behaviors is it functions a little like this. Now, don't think of the number 7. So don't think about sex. Don't, you know. The little kid in us hears that as think about sex, or think about 7, or, you know, that our mind jumps over the don't and gets hooked on whatever it is. So rather than focusing so much on the don't, focus on what is it I really want out of life? What is it that I'm really looking for? And how can I find that in a fuller way? In other words, move from the don'ts to where do we want to go and what is God offering? So it becomes a positive thing rather than a total don't kind of thing. Tomorrow I'm going to do an experiential process of moving from death to life. And to give you some way of experiencing that. And it'll be a private experience. It's not something you have to share with others. But I'll guide you through some processes to look at these things in your life and experience what it means to let go of them, and what it means to die with Christ, and what it means then to walk in the newness of life. So I would welcome you if you'd like to do that. And then on Friday, let's talk about what are the implications of these things for our individual lives and for the life of the church. Thank you. Mm-hmm.